Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Law Christian Fellowship, I'd like to welcome you here to the talk this evening. Law Christian Fellowship, for those of you who don't know, meets every Thursday night over in the cafeteria, and we meet together to worship and fellowship and take some time to talk about issues like this where our faith and our future legal careers intersect. Our speaker tonight is Lieutenant Colonel Couch, Stuart Couch. He's a senior appellate judge for the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals. He's a North Carolina native. Went to Duke University, joined the Marine Corps after that, followed that with Campbell Law School, and he worked for the Marine JAG, where he was on a team that prosecuted the flight team that clipped the gondola cable in Aviano, Italy. And following a brief stint in private practice, he rejoined the Marine Corps and worked in the Office of Military Commissions. He's going to talk about that time tonight. We thank Colonel Couch for coming, taking time out of his day to come down to Charlottesville from D.C., and hope you enjoy. We'll have time for questions afterwards, and we have plenty of food, and we have some soft drinks ready. So feel free to stay and ask Colonel Couch questions on your own afterwards, and enjoy the good food. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Colin. I appreciate that. And thank you all for coming. I'm really glad to be here at another trip here to University of Virginia. I was down here last week at the JAG School teaching an operations law class, and I see some of our JAG School students with us, and I appreciate you showing up as well. My comments here, I'm probably going to run about 45 minutes or so, and then after that, we'll just shoot the moon. You can ask what questions you have. Whether it be in front of everybody or also, as Colin indicated, informally, I'd be willing to stick around, and as long as somebody's got some questions, I can provide what answers I can come up with. At any rate, I do need to have a disclaimer here, and I apologize for this, but because I'm speaking to a bunch of lawyers or law students, you will understand that we have some ethics constraints out there, and so my comments are based upon my personal opinion. Only they do not reflect those beliefs of the Department of Defense, the Department of the Navy, United States Marine Corps. And furthermore, any comment I make here tonight shouldn't be taken as any indication how myself or another judge on the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals might rule in any particular case. So having gotten all that legalese out of the way, let's get down to it. Okay. One point that Colin didn't mention it, and it's because it's kind of buried in things. Before I was a lawyer, I was a pilot in the Marine Corps, and there is a method in my madness. Don't think that this is just some period of self-aggrandizement that I'm going to devolve into. But there were a period of about 5 years where I went to flight training, and I was a C-130 pilot in the Marine Corps. And this is a picture, actually, it's from one of my old squadron planes. This is what we would do. We would tank jets in flight, amongst other stuff. But the one thing that you got to know about flying any aircraft in the military is there is a necessity to know and understand navigation. This is actually a photograph taken off of the flight deck of a Marine C-130, and that's kind of what it looks like. So you can imagine there's a lot going on, and you have to know your craft of navigation. And so I'd like to start off, not to sound too pedantic, but I've got some points about navigation and how I've sort of applied that to the legal profession that I'd like to share with you, and to use this as sort of a grid work, if you will, for the other comments that I'm going to make tonight and an explanation of sort of my experience in the Office of Military Commissions. Okay, do we have any Boy Scouts in the crowd? Got any Boy Scouts out there? Y'all remember map and compass work? And you got three basic pieces to navigation, right? You got your map, you got your terrain that you got to figure out how to cross over, and then finally, you have a compass, okay? Now, if anybody's ever worked with a map and compass, you're confronted with terrain. Either you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, I got to figure out how to get across that, or you're getting ready to get out of the car and you're trying to figure out how to do this. But at any rate, you do it the same way every time. And that is, you're
perceiving the terrain, you have a map, but then before you can go to use that map, you must orient it to a compass. And sometimes it's so simple, just lay the map on the ground, put a compass on top of it, you get the compass pointing towards north, and you rotate the map until the north line on the map aligns with the north line on the compass. And then and only then can you take a look out in front of you and see if you can figure out where to go. Alright, well, as applied to the legal profession, or I would submit really to any kind of profession, here goes my pitch. That map is like your education or your experience. You think about a map. It's something produced by another human being with the aid of a computer, right? Big old piece of paper with a bunch of squiggly lines. And it's something somebody else is trying to impute to you as to what exists out there in space. Okay, everybody, you with me there? By the way, I'm a trial lawyer, okay? So I apologize if it sounds like I'm making a pitch to jury. That's the only way I can do this stuff. All right. So basically, your education, and I think to some degree your life experience, it's what you've picked up from others and imputed to you as knowledge. Okay? But, well, let me get to that here in a second. The terrain is basically life, or life issues, those things that you encounter in your life. And basically, you got this map or this education, and you've got this issue. But frankly, if you don't align it with a compass, that education is worthless to you. And that's where I would submit to you that the compass is the moral compass. Okay? Basically, your moral compass informs and directs your education and experience to allow you to resolve the issue in front of you and to make your way forward in life. Alright, so here we go. My moral compass. My moral compass points to Jesus Christ. And I will tell you, I'm unapologetic on that. You pay your dollar, you get the holler, so there it is. Okay? Me sharing that with you is one of the reasons I have to make a disclaimer at the beginning of this speech. Now, you know, we might have some people that don't subscribe to the Christian faith. In the audience tonight, we might have some people that subscribe to another faith, or really no faith at all. The one thing I want to submit to you is this. This is what works for me. Okay? And tonight, you're going to hear a little bit of how my moral compass kind of kicked in and ultimately helped me make a really hard decision in a difficult case. But I want to submit, especially to the law students that are with us tonight, if you don't have a moral compass, if you think you got one but you're not sure how well it works, now is the time for you to be breaking the code on that. Here in the educational environment, especially in such a fantastic institution as the University of Virginia, you've got the time and you've got the resources, and frankly, you've got a lot of other people around to help you develop that moral compass. And it comes from a variety of things. You know, for me, it comes through the Christian faith. You also can get components of that from philosophy, other things that you read. And you're going to see some of that reflected here in a moment. So anyway, these three things, the map, the terrain, the compass, I'm going to talk in those terms to explain what I went through with the Office of Military Commissions. Okay, this is part of the terrain. This is Miriam Horrocks, the widow of a friend of mine, Mike Horrocks. Mike's call sign in the squadron was Rocks, as you can imagine. Fantastic guy, quarterback. At a small school up near Philadelphia. Fantastic athlete, and of the junior pilots in the squadron, of which I was one of them, he had the best hands in the squadron. That's our pilot commentary for he had the best aeronautical skills in the squadron, of the captains and below. Mike and I were in the squadron for about 3 years together. I left to go to law school. Mike went on to be an instructor pilot Pensacola, Florida, and then he got out of the Marine Corps and went to fly for United. And he was the co-pilot of the second plane to hit the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, United Flight 175. A couple years later, I was working on a case, not the Salahi case, but the case of Muhammad Al-Qahtani. He's detainee number 63, or the 20th hijacker. I was the lead prosecutor in that case. And I started working with an FBI agent who was probably the most knowledgeable guy about 9/11 that I've ever met. And I remember saying to Fitz, was his name, I said, "Hey, Fitz, this is a personal question. Can you tell me what happened on flight United 175? Because, you know, my friend was the co-pilot, and they were the second plane to hit the World Trade Center, and I've got a perhaps a morbid curiosity." And Fitz told me that that was the plane that we know the least about of the four airplanes that were attacked on 9/11. But by the best thing we can tell, Mike probably had his throat slit with a box cutter and was dead on the flight deck at the time that the airplane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. I tell you, this is the terrain. This photograph, this is Miriam and Mike's, Miriam with their children. I didn't know Mike Jr. on the left here. He wasn't born yet when we were in, together at Cherry Point. But their daughter, Krista, on the right, I remember when she was born. This photograph was on the front page of USA Today 3 days after 9/11. This photograph was given to me, a copy of it was given to me when I got to the Office of Military Commissions, and it sat on my desk for the 3 years that I was there. I tell you all the story about Mike Horrocks because, you know, 9/11 is the terrain for everybody, all Americans. It was specifically the terrain that we were contending with in the Office of Military Commissions in the prosecution effort. But for me, part of that terrain was the fact that I'd had a friend of mine that was killed as a result of these attacks. And that really never left my mind. This is another part of the terrain. And this individual's name is Mamdou Aoud Slahi. This was a case that I was handed when I checked into the office in August of 2003. Slahi is an interesting dude. He's a tiny little guy. He speaks about five languages. Lived in Duisburg, Germany for the better part of 9 years. He also lived for approximately 3 years in Toronto, Canada. While he's in Toronto, Canada, he attended the same mosque as Ahmed Rassam, who some of you might realize or remember was the leader of the Millennium Bomb Plot. And he's now doing a lot of time out at the Supermax facility in Colorado. At any rate, Slahi, when he was living in Germany, became involved, we believe, with members of the Hamburg cell. Or I'm talking about Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was the right-hand man for 9/11. Muhammad Atta, who was the operational commander and the pilot of the first plane to hit the World Trade Center. Ziad Jarrah, who was the pilot of the plane that went into the farmer's field in Pennsylvania. And also Marwan al-Sheikhi, who was the pilot of the plane that went into the second plane that went into the World Trade Center. There was, when I got the case of Slahi, he was at Guantanamo. And he, of all the detainees at Guantanamo, and remember this is August of 2003, of all the detainees at Guantanamo, at that time we had over 600 of them, he was one of very few, I think probably one of two, the other one being Al-Qahtani, that had a connection to 9/11. Okay? All the rest of these individuals, you know, they were picked up on the battlefield, they were had been to some training camps. Some of them were explosives operatives and whatnot, but the only two that we could figure out had a connection to 9/11 were Slahi and Al-Qahtani. Unfortunately, both of them wound up being my case. Now, Slahi, what we knew about him at that time in August of 2003, he wasn't particularly forthcoming with the intelligence interrogators that he had. What information we did have came from Ramzi bin al-Shib. Again, he was the right-hand man for 9/11. So then, as a trial lawyer, and let me pause here for a moment. Understand, at this time, when I'm working these cases, I'm looking at everything through the perspective of a trial lawyer. Okay? And any trial lawyer will tell you that evidence has got to have credibility. I mean, you got all kinds of wickets you got to get through with your evidence. You've got the rules of evidence. You've got all sorts of motions to try to suppress that evidence using those rules. But the bottom line is, even if you pass all of the legal wickets to get the evidence in front of a jury, it still has to have credibility. Because you still got a bunch of human beings sitting in the box, and you got to convince them that what you're telling them and the case that you're presenting is exactly what went down. And in the case of Slahi, we were thinking at that time that he might be a capital case. We might seek the death penalty on this dude. So the credibility has got to be right. And myself and other prosecutors in the office, we realized that there was an issue with how some of this evidence had been obtained. And basically, the idea that not only if it's obtained as a result of coercion or torture, one, you've got some legal prescriptions to that, and I'm going to go through that here in a little bit. But more importantly, it lacks credibility. And don't think for a minute that just because it's a military jury, you know, they're going to say, okay, bring the guilty bastard in here. Let's give him a fair trial. Okay, it doesn't work that way. In the most high-profile case I've ever tried, the Italian ski gondola case, there was an acquittal of the pilot in that case. The evidence was extremely good. That's a whole other lecture I can give. But I had lived through that. I dealt with that. And I understand the value of credibility of the evidence in front of the jury. So the one piece of evidence that I had in August of 2003 connecting Slahi to 9/11 was what Ramzi bin al-Shib had to say. So then I started asking the question, okay, where's Ramzi bin al-Shib? Well, we don't know. Well, hang on here. We got it. And by the way, I'm not telling you anything classified, okay? Everything about this case has been vetted in front of Congress through the Schmidt furlough investigation. It's been testified to in front of Congress. Basically, I've never had to say anything classified to anybody because it's all out there. It's all been declassified, you know, long before the Wall Street Journal article. Wall Street Journal wrote an article about it. But the bottom line was, I'm asking the question, where's Ramzi bin al-Shib? Well, we don't know. Well, I'm looking at an intelligence report, and they got a lot of information in there, what that guy's got to say, and he's talking a lot about Slahi. What do you mean we don't know where it is? Well, we can't say. So we now know that he was in the custody of the Central Intelligence Agency and another site somewhere away. We used to call that Hotel California. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. And so we would just say, well, he's in Hotel California. And that's just shorthand for he's in the custody of the agency, and we don't know. Now, at the time I'm asking these questions, I happen to be the liaison from our office to the CIA. I have a top secret clearance with sensitive compartmented information clearance. That's about as high as you can get as a military guy. And notwithstanding my top secret SCI clearance, I'm being told, we can't tell you. We refuse to confirm or deny that he is in the custody of the agency. And I'm like, okay, well, if I got that part. Can you tell me what was being used to get the information from him? Can we talk about who was around? Because you've given me this intelligence report as evidence. No. Notwithstanding your TSSCI clearance, we're not going to tell you anything. We're not even going to confirm or deny that the guy is in the custody of the United States. So you can imagine I'm starting to think, okay, we might have a problem here. About the same time that I'm having a concern over that piece of evidence, I get word that Slahi has now been put on special projects. I said, okay, what special projects mean? Well, it's some sort of special interrogation plan, but we don't know anything about it, and it doesn't sound good. And I'm asking the question formally, and again, why am I asking the question? Not because I'm some left-wing liberal, you know, Amnesty International dude, ACLU. I'm asking the question because I'm a stinking trial lawyer trying to figure out the credibility of my evidence. And, okay, what special projects? Well, don't know really, but it doesn't sound good. I mean, that was the answer I got back. The investigator, the criminal investigator that was working with me on this case, is an investigator for the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. I can't say his name publicly because of the current billet that he's in. It's very sensitive. But he's a former Marine, and we were sharing a brain on this case. We both had the same view of things. And the difference is that he had access to the intelligence side of things. So he was getting under the table. He was finding out what was being done with Slahi. In the fall of 2003, literally overnight, Slahi starts singing like a canary. I could not keep up with the intelligence reports that were coming out of the guy. He was pushing out about five or six intelligence reports a day, which is a lot. And so I'm begging the question, okay, these special projects must be working. What's involved in it? And the response back was, just prosecute the case. You don't have the need to know what the interrogation plans are about. And that, and so we're like, okay, you know, we'll do what we can do. Now, from this point forward, for the next 9 months, as I'm working the case, I want to be real clear about this. I assumed that anything that Slahi said about his own treatment, that he would be lying. And my assumption comes from a document. We call it the Manchester Training Manual. It's found in Manchester, England. It's basically a training manual for all of Al-Qaeda, where they say, if you're ever captured by the infidels, start telling everybody you got tortured. Because they got a real small strike zone for that stuff, and it'll take attention away from you and take the pressure off. So my assumption was, whatever lie he said about his treatment, he was going to lie about it and say that he was tortured. When I ultimately made the decision not to prosecute his case, it was based upon documents that I had seen that were created by the United States government. Documents that they had intended that I would not see, but my resourceful criminal investigator got them underneath the table. I'll talk a little bit more about my decision matrix in a moment. Okay, now, just because you thought you were coming to the Law of Christian Fellowship speech tonight that you weren't going to get a little bit of ethics tone here, too bad. All right, so here it goes. This is from the American Bar Association Model Rules. Rule 2.1, attorney as counselor. Real bright crowd here, smarter than I am. You guys can all read it, but check out the stuff written in yellow. Okay? What this is saying is that when you're representing a client, and as a prosecutor, I consider myself representing the United States government, okay, that I've got to give that independent professional judgment, and the bottom line is I can consider and give advice on other considerations, such as moral, economic, social, and political factors. All of this stuff was coming due, okay? I'll get to the my next ethics rule here in a moment. I'll talk about some of the hard and fast law. But specifically for me, I thought that we had some moral issues there, obviously, as we started finding out that some of these detainees were mistreated. And we definitely had political factors. Now, let me tell you the one part for me that where the moral factors really kicked in. In October of 2003, I went to Guantanamo for my first trip. And this was basically to take a look at the place and see what it was all about, and also see the detainees and how they were being treated, because again, that's going to be a factor we're going to have to deal with when we bring them before the bar in a prosecution. I went to a trailer that was in Camp Delta, an interrogation trailer, and it's like these prefab trailers, you've seen them. Some of you probably went to school in them if you went to public school. At any rate, I'm sitting in a room behind a two-way mirror because I was going to watch the interrogation of another detainee that I was prosecuting. Actually, a fairly polite guy to be a terrorist, but he was a very cooperative dude, so I was going to watch an interrogation and just to size him up. I always like to do that when I'm prosecuting somebody, to size them up to get an idea in my mind, what are they going to act like when they hit the courtroom. So I'm waiting for this interview to begin, and I hear this rock music blaring down the hallway. I mean, I call it razor blade music. We got any Metallica fans out there? Yeah, I can't stand that stuff. I mean, I'll listen to just about anything. You know, my kids over here playing with my iPod, and I got all kinds of really cool stuff on there, wide variety of music, but I hate heavy metal. Well, I hear this heavy metal blaring down the hallway, and I'm thinking that it's a couple of, you know, enlisted Marines or sailors or soldiers down there, you know, not thinking that we were in the trailer, and they're just having a good time until, you know, the next evolution. So I go, you know, in my full, you know, Marine Lieutenant Colonel, you know, kind of, you know, going to chew on somebody's leg sort of attitude, I go barreling down the hallway, and as I come up on the source of the music, the door is open, and I can see flashes of a strobe light coming. And when I rounded the corner and I looked inside the room, it was black except for the strobe lights. And the music was just deafening coming out. There's two big speakers on the sides. And in the corner of the room was a detainee in orange, shackled, hands to his feet. And he's rocking back and forth, and I could tell that he was praying. Now, at that moment, I had a flashback. You know, I told you I was a pilot. Well, here comes Here comes, aside from the navigation piece, here comes the reason why I told you that. Most Marine pilots have to go to a thing called SEER school. And SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It's basically a school, it's the only school in the Department of Defense where the instructors are allowed to beat the students, physically assault you. Because it's a school where they teach you how you're going to be treated, or the close approximation of how you're going to be treated if you're ever taken as a prisoner of war. It's a week long. They don't feed you for about 4 days. Then you turn up into a prisoner of war camp, and then there's mock interrogations of it. And they run a whole variety of things. I can't go into all of that because, to my knowledge, it's still classified, although they've been talking about it on the Hill, chapter and verse, since all this stuff came out. But basically, SEER school is what we learned of the treatment of Americans at the hands of the North Vietnamese and the hands of the North Koreans. They took that information and built a school around that treatment so that we could train our air crew what to deal with if they were ever taken in custody by a communist country like that. Now, here's a key point. What do you think communists, their goal is when they're interrogating you in a situation like that? Think back to Vietnam. Their goal is propaganda. Their goal is not intelligence. Okay? So that's what SEER school was about. The push was to get propaganda out of it. And yeah, they were trying to get intelligence out of us, but the key point that I came away with was it was propaganda that they were trying to get. Well, what we now know is that SEER school deal was what the decision makers that came up with the policy for these enhanced interrogations, that's what they used. Was what we've been doing at SEER school. And the argument was something along the lines of, hey, we can do it to our own air crew, our own American servicemen and women. Surely it's got to pass international muster under international law, treaty, and customary, that we can do it to these guys in Guantanamo, and we'll be good to go. All right? And we now know that. I mean, it's an established fact that they talked about SEER tech. Well, my problem, when I'm looking at it in October 2003, was I had been through that. I knew what that was like. I knew what that experience was like, and immediately told me a few things. Number three was any evidence that comes out of that is not credible. It ain't ever going to work. And it's not only going to affect the credibility of the confession that you got out of the guy you're prosecuting, which is about 90% of the evidence that we had in most of those cases at the time. It's also going to affect the witness statements of other detainees that you're using against the accused, their credibility is going to be attacked because now the question is, all right, were you on special projects when you dined out Ahmed over here? All right? Most importantly, it offended my own moral belief. And here it is. God created man in his own image. And based upon that, that's what I believe as a Christian. And that respect for the human dignity of every human being is a thread that runs throughout the length of American jurisprudence. That Judeo-Christian ethic of respect for the dignity of every human being. A lot of our laws are based upon that. Shoot, go back and take a look at the Bill of Rights. Man, it's all over it. It's in the Declaration of Independence. Chapter and verse. It's in the UN. The UN, I'm losing it right now, basically the Manifest for Human Rights, okay? Universal Declaration of Human Rights, thank you. It's all over that. And that was what offended me the most. Now, I don't like these guys from Al-Qaeda. They killed a friend of mine. They killed almost 3,000 of my countrymen in the most horrific manner possible. They killed a bunch of kids on a school trip that flew out of Dulles, flying out to California when they drove it into the Pentagon. Bunch of lower income kids from Southeast D.C., first time on an airplane. Those bastards murdered every one of them. Okay? I don't have any love for them. I don't like them. But the bottom line is this. They are human beings. And that when they're in the custody of our country, I believe that they are due a certain level of treatment. And that's just not stick out talking. That's the GPW3 and the Geneva Conventions. common Article 3. We have a very basic set of requirements for how we treat this canyon. So, at any rate, that's part of the terrain, and that was part of the moral problem that I had when I saw what I saw in October of 2003. We're still on the map part, by the way. If you haven't figured that out, everybody's following along in your pew Bibles. All right. Attorney is the advocate. Rule 3.1. A lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert a contravening issue therein unless there's a basis in law and fact for doing so that's not frivolous. It's not wild. All right. We had a guy in the office, an Air Force officer, attorney, and he was an international law expert, had an LLM. I could barely spell international law. I know a little bit of it now, although you've already seen me stumble over a couple things. But I went to Major Preston and I said, all right, hey, look, I've heard talk about a UN torture convention. And some people call it the CAT for short, Convention Against Torture and the Cruel, Inhumane, and Degrading Treatment. And I believe it was a treaty that was signed in the Clinton administration, ratified by Congress, I believe it was 1996, and adopted as domestic law. Basically, that's part of the treaty deal, that once the United States signs a treaty, lots of times there'll be a part of the treaty that says, okay, the signatory countries have to adopt it into their domestic law for the treaty to have effect. And so what we did in the United States was the protections, it basically prohibits torture and the cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of people. When it was adopted into domestic law, it came under the War Crimes Act. Okay? Everybody tracking with me? All right, that's all the international law we're going to talk. All right, but basically I went to Preston and I said, hey, I've heard about this CAT treaty. Is there anything in that CAT treaty that the defense can use against us when the time comes to put on evidence, because they're going to be hearing from their clients, hey, I got thumped or whatever. And at that time, I saw what I saw in Guantanamo, and that was what we knew. The other case, Al-Qahtani, who I wound up being the prosecutor for, we knew that something bad had happened to Al-Qahtani. We knew that the interrogators had almost killed him, and he wound up in the hospital. Apparently, his heart rate got down to like 35 beats a minute. It's all out there. Time magazine did a big thing on it. Just type in Muhammad Al-Qahtani on the internet, and you'll get bored and everyone will know about it. But we knew that there were some issues in Guantanamo. We also knew there were some issues with the treatment of detainees when they came through Bagram, Afghanistan, circa fall of 2002. And again, it was not just me. There were other prosecutors in the office. We were sensitive to this, again, as how it attacked credibility. We were looking at all these things, but we started getting a picture that, hey, you know, detainee treatment is going to be huge for us. So that's why I went to Preston and said, okay, what is going to be the legal mechanism under international law that the defense counsel are going to try to pull a rabbit out of their hat and use against them? At that time, the rules of evidence of these military commissions, the discovery rule was anything the prosecution intends to use against the detainee at trial or evidence of an exculpatory nature known to the prosecution. So it's like written right into it, okay, you can have willful ignorance. So if the other agencies say, you know what, we're not going to let the prosecution see any of this stuff, therefore they won't have to turn it over to the defense. Okay? At least that was my interpretation of it. So what Preston came back with, he said, check it out. Article 15 of the CAT says that if there is a statement that is the product of torture, that it cannot be used against an accused in any proceeding. Any proceeding. And so my interpretation of that was, wow, we got the military commissions, the president's military order right here telling us, you know, what the rules are. And we had the authority to do military commissions, been doing them since the Revolutionary War. Hadn't done them since World War II, that's all right, worked at Nuremberg. You know, we got that right there. But external to it, over here, we've got this international treaty, which has been ratified by Congress, adopted as domestic law, that's got an exclusionary rule in it. It's going to trump. It's going to trump over that. And so that was the big concern I had. That's why I went from a perspective. All of this came down. Really, the balloon went up in roughly May of 2004, 9 months after I'd gotten the case, is when I ultimately went to the chief prosecutor with my concerns. But before I get to that, a little more piece of the map here, okay? United States Supreme Court case law. You do a Lexis search for confessions and coerced confessions, and this case comes up.
And I'm not going to read to you because you guys are all too smart. I'll take a break to drink some water. Okay, we've got a lot of really smart law students and lawyers in here. Take a look at that. When was that decision handed down? 1944. It's a state case out of Tennessee. And basically, what the police were doing to this guy, Ashcraft, kind of paled in comparison with some of the weird stuff that I ultimately saw that went on in Guantanamo and Bagram. Think about 1944. What's going on in the United States of America when these Supreme Court justices decided this thing? Okay? A lot more threat going on out there against the United States. A lot more, you know, I mean, I guess you could say historically, you know, we had a lot hanging in the balance. We got a lot hanging in the balance now because of 9/11, but I don't think it, 1944, we're in the middle of World War II. And they still went so far as to decide this case. So, those ethics rules I showed you, the CAT, the Article 15, this case law, bunch of other case law, all that stuff, that's my map I'm dealing with. And I'm dealing with the terrain of sliding. So here's the last little bit of terrain I have on sliding. Finally, 9 months after I've been working the case, I've got this great agent who's just stealing stuff under the table from the intelligence side. I mean, they had a cow when they found out how much stuff this guy was getting. I found out a lot of stuff about Al Qahtani from Time Magazine. That's how well they did of keeping the evidence from me. And I was the lead prosecutor with a top secret clearance. All right? But ultimately, what got my goat from sliding, what they had done is put him on the frequent flyer. And think about this. When I start laying out the different things that they're doing, any one of them's not such a bad deal, but think about what it looks like in the totality. Okay? So just kind of bear that in mind. They put him on the frequent flyer, or Operation Sandman program. And basically what this is they move him every couple of hours from his cell, his detention area, to another. Make a point of getting him up in the middle of the night, and that's the Operation Sandman piece, just so they can't sleep. And, I mean, I went through officer candidate school in the Marine Corps in Quantico, and back then we only got 3 hours of sleep a night. After a few weeks of that, starts working on your noodle pretty good. This guy, you know he didn't ever get a break. They found out that he had some issues about sex with relations with his wife. He and his wife had been trying to get pregnant, and that wasn't working. He had issues about his mom, and they figured out these sex things. So they had a sex room. Pictures of women having babies, and babies breastfeeding, and painted in pink and blue. I'm not making this stuff up. And so after they'd been doing all this sleep deprivation stuff with him, and the music and the lights and all this, and then they got the sex room going. Then they had interrogators doing role plays with him. I got to be careful on some of this because not all of it is out there. But basically, the interrogator comes in. There was one interrogator that he would only wear a black mask over his face, Mr. X. And Mr. X, by the way, was the guy that was kind of running this whole thing. You know, Mr. X comes in there and says, you know, I was having a dream the other night. And it was in Guantanamo, and there was a casket, and it had 760 written on the lid. And by the way, Slade's number was 760. And it was a casket. And they were lowering it to the ground and put the dirt in over on top of it. And he was buried in Guantanamo, never to return home. Okay. So he's not saying, all right, we're going to go out and shoot your ass. Okay? But the clear implication is, you know, you're going to be buried there. They took him out, made him believe he was going to be taken off the island and taken to another country. They had people walking around speaking in Arabic, and then, strangely, think Sioux Indian. Some dude did not speak Sioux Indian, so they had the guy freaking out. They let him out, and he thought he was going to be executed, and he urinated on himself. And I know that because one of the guys that was there was laughing about it and told a fellow prosecutor about it, a colonel. Tells my fellow prosecutor, yeah, this was one of the guys in charge of the intel section. Yeah, it was hilarious, and I was right behind him when he did it. For me, the tipping point came when this whole thing about Mr. X comes in dressed up as an officer, wearing a lot more rank than he had, and says that he was from the White House and that he had this document from the State Department
or from the Department of Defense to the State Department saying basically, and they'd already told Salahi that his mom and his brother had been captured and were in the custody of the United States. And they said in the letter basically, you know, his mom is going to be brought to Guantanamo. She's the first and only female detainee at Guantanamo. There's a lot of other males at Guantanamo. We have grave concerns about our ability to protect her from them. And I'm just paraphrasing that. Clear implication, his mom's going to get gang raped because they're going to bring her to Guantanamo. So there's another piece of evidence that was top secret. I can't reveal to you what it is, but basically in tandem, when I finally was holding this false letter, I had this classified information that I can't discuss, and all of this other stuff, I got to the point where I said, I it's like I said in the article, I had read enough, I had seen enough, I had heard enough, I had enough. Bottom line. And I went into the chief, well, the first thing that happened, I'm just struggling because I said, you know, that's it. I don't know what to do. I've got this guy, I believe what's happened to him has met the definition of torture. And it's right there in the cab. I believe what's happened to him and the whole mental suffering piece. We had set up mental suffering on this guy. And I can't tell you how I know that, but at any rate, I felt like we had met the definition of torture under the cap. And so now the question is, what do I do about it? And part of me just said, you know what? I can go through the motions. It'll probably never go to trial. I can go in there and draw a line in the sand. I can put this thing in writing, my hope being it gets communicated from us up over to the Pentagon, to the General Counsel's office. Not to say, hey, look, we agree with Couch, but say, hey, we got this weird prosecutor down here who's got a problem with this stuff. Houston, we've got a problem. To maybe make somebody take a step back from that policy decision to say, we need to think about the third and fourth order effects of this policy decision. But ultimately, what got me to act was I was at the Falls Church. That's where I go to church in Falls Church, Virginia. Great big old Anglican church, and on this particular Sunday, we had a baptism. We got any Episcopalians or Anglicans in the crowd? Yeah, we're down here at UVA, so I'm figuring we got a few of them. All right. When we do a baptism in the Anglican tradition, the minister, there's a liturgy, and they're reading out of the book, kind of prayer. And at one point, the congregation stands up and answers responsibly to a series of questions. And they're really the tenets of the faith. And so it doesn't matter if it's your kid or not getting baptized. Everybody in that whole big 1,000-person congregation stands up. And these questions get asked. And the last one is, do you respect the dignity of everyone? Will you seek justice in the earth, on the earth and agree to respect the dignity of every human being? I'm paraphrasing. Probably should have that up on the slide as well. On this Sunday, when I heard that, I could have been the only dude in the church. It was like a thunderclap upside the head. And you know, I don't ever propose that God tells me X. You know, I'm not going to pull a Oral Roberts on you or anything like that. I felt at that moment, I just got shook to my inmost being that this was a bigger issue and that I had to do something. And I felt as if it was God putting the thumb on me. You know, all right, Couch, you're going to come in here on Sundays and do all this good liturgy stuff, you know, out there in the pews, but then what are you going to do with it the other 6 days of the week? You going to live by this stuff or not? I was so upset about it, I went and saw my pastor right after the service was over. Bowled over for 2 days, and then I went to the chief prosecutor, and I said, I ain't got to talk to you, and here's the deal. Legal, ethical, moral. Legally, based upon the definition of torture in the CAT and the Article 15 provision and everything else I already showed you guys and talked about and a lot more, I believe that this guy was tortured. Okay? And I believe that there's a good faith basis, and this goes back to that one of those ethics rules I showed you as attorney, as counsel. There's a good faith basis, I believe, that Article 15 exclusionary provision is going to kick in. Okay, that's legally, and I'm really paraphrasing. Ethically, I believe that when this guy gets a defense lawyer, I'm going to have an ethical duty to share with them what I have learned about his case so that his attorney can avail themselves of the protections of Article 15. I think I've got an ethical duty, and I think that ethical duty goes above and outside the discovery rules that we've got under these military commissions. Okay? And we were getting accused all the time that we had Brady proof, that we were trying to apply Brady versus Maryland to these guys and they didn't rate it. Well, frankly, Brady is so dadgum ingrained in all the career prosecutors, you really can't get away from it. So I had a legal piece, I had an ethical piece, and then I said morally, I find what's been done to this guy to be reprehensible, and for that reason alone, I refuse to have any further participation in this case. The chief prosecutor, and it was not Colonel Bork, by the way, it was his successor, so I throw that out. Colonel Bork was a great guy to work for. This guy flies offhand and says, what makes you think you're just better than everybody else around here? And immediately attacked me, you know, attacked the messenger and not the message. You know, his whole thing was, no Supreme Court case law applies to these guys. International law, and I wrote it down one day in a morning meeting, I don't want to hear the words international law spoken in this office ever again. Well, you know, international law is what we're prosecuting these guys with. Violations of law of armed conflict. Again, when I got into the office, I could barely spell international law, and by now I know enough that that's what we've got to work with. Attacking the messenger, not the message. And I just went off on him. I said, I don't think I'm any better than anybody around here. I'm just trying to do my job. 2 days later, I took that conversation we had and I put it in writing, put it in a memorandum. My hope was that he would share that memorandum up the street, the general counsel's office, and he didn't do it. And apparently that was never shared. The crazy thing is 9 months later, after Abu Ghraib broke, they kicked off a great big investigation, the Schmidt-Furlow investigation. They never knew that I had refused to prosecute Salahi. And Salahi was one of the two most important focuses of the Schmidt-Furlow investigation, the other one being Al Qahtani. I kind of felt vindicated when I saw what Schmidt-Furlow came out in front of Congress. They had resolved the same problems in the case that I had. They didn't agree with me on the definition of torture. But then again, neither Schmidt nor Furlow were lawyers. I am. So there. at any rate, there was, and I won't go all into the details because I want to get to the question and answer session here. But I stayed on in the office for another 2 years. They weren't too mad at me because at some point I was a lead prosecutor in Hondon versus Rumsfeld. Basically, the Supreme Court's ruling in Hondon versus Rumsfeld, I got to get out of jail free card. I got to leave the office a month later because I was being kept in the military prosecution's office, the military commission's office, until Hondon was done. I was liaison to the Solicitor General from our office, assisted him in both of his moot court arguments, preparing for Hondon v. Rumsfeld. That's a whole other story. So if anybody's got any questions about Hondon versus Rumsfeld, unfortunately, I know a little bit about it. And as I said, after that case was decided, a month later, I got my get out of jail free card, and I went to my current billet as a senior appellate judge. Okay. A few final thoughts, and this goes back to what was informing my moral compass. This right here is a quote that I found when I was working that Italian ski gondola case. Epictetus was a Greek Stoic philosopher, as a slave who made good and wound up being a philosopher. And from where I come from in North Carolina, basically what this says is, if you're doing the right thing, you ought not be concerned that anybody sees you doing it. Because if they make a wrong supposition about it, who cares? I've had this, all my years as a prosecutor, I had that taped over my desk. And at military commissions, it was hanging right there on the wall. So I don't know where the chief prosecutor, what he thought he was going to get from me if he sees that hanging up in my office. Another thing that informed my moral belief is this guy, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Anybody know anything about Bonhoeffer? He was martyred. He was a theologian in Germany, was executed by the Nazis about a week and a half before Hitler blew his brains out in April of 1945.
I'm a real big fan of this book. And I thought this was pretty applicable to what we've been dealing with in our war on terror in the aftermath of 9/11. Again, this guy's writing this stuff back in the 30s and early 40s. I'm a big fan of this guy, too. Pretty nasty picture of him. That's C.S. Lewis. This is what Lewis has got to say that I think is pretty applicable to military commissions. I thought that last sentence was pretty applicable. So, this is some of the best words ever spoken on this topic. This was from the floor debate in 2005 when they were debating the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, coming from Senator John McCain. If anybody knows what it feels like, he probably does. He spent 5 years in Hua Lo prison for the Hanoi Hilton at the hands of the Vietnamese. It's not about them, it's about us. So having said that, we got any questions?